This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're having a chance now to find out about an interesting pair of cleanup days that are going to be happening in two separate neighborhoods in the city of Gary very soon. And we'll find out more from Father Mike. Well, that's what he would like his parishioners to call him. We're talking about Father Mike Sarufka, who is the, I guess he's first the pastor of the Holy Name of Jesus Parish in Cedar Lake in South Lake County. But he's picked up another title as well, too, and we'll find out more about it. Father Mike, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for the chance to chat together, Nick. Chris, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're taking on the duties here with the change of leadership in the Gary Diocese as the administrator of the Cathedral of Holy Angels, which is in the neighborhood west of downtown Gary. And you're also administrator, too, of the Church of Saints Monica and Luke, which is in the Emerson neighborhood. And I know that they're both neighborhoods that are old, established neighborhoods, but sad to say, just as much of the city of Gary has fallen into as kind of a bit of disrepair. Tell us about your concerns after you took over as the administrator in the parishes you've had added on, and what you're hoping to be able to do about it.
Well, it's a big task, as you can imagine, and I'm not exactly sure how it's all going to turn out when it's all put together. But how it happened was with the bishop being transferred to Madison, Wisconsin, left a gap in the Cathedral Parish and St. Monica Luke Parish, where he had served as pastor as well as bishop of the whole diocese. So in addition to my responsibilities here at Holy Name in Cedar Lake, I was asked to also take on the responsibility for at least administering for the time being until a new bishop comes. The parishes up in Gary that the bishop had been responsible for. So my first task really is to get to know the communities in the Emerson neighborhood and the Cathedral neighborhood, serve the people there the best I can. But also, what I think was interesting, Nick, is that the two parish communities, so the North Lake and South Lake communities here, are interested in getting to know each other across the opposite ends of the county, if you can imagine. People who seemingly might seem they're very different from each other actually have so much in common. And so one of the ways that we want to get to know each other is to have sort of just a little neighborhood cleanup where some of the Holy Name folks can head up into Gary and help clean up some of the lots that are littered and strewn and covered with weeds and maybe meet some of the neighbors up there and begin to make some links.
Have you had a chance, even before that we've had the change in leadership with the diocese and you've had to take over as the administrator in those two parishes, have you had a chance to visit the neighborhoods to kind of take a look at the area around the cathedral and around Saints Monica and Luke?
Yes, I have. And because I've had a lot of experience in urban ministry, I was in 15 years in Cleveland, Ohio, on the east side of Cleveland. I'm very familiar with the struggles that urban neighborhoods go through as the economy transitions, as demographics change, and to realize that in the heart of neighborhoods that look and actually are rather distressed, there are so many points of commitment and love and real cherishing of neighborhoods. And I'm also aware from my experience before that people who live outside of struggling neighborhoods often have perceptions of those neighborhoods that may not be quite accurate. Yes, I did drive around, check things out, but I'm not put off by an occasional boarded house or some overgrowth in a lot. That doesn't bother me at all. I see those as invitations for communities to find ways of renewing.
We know, of course, that there are some sections of Gary that are in, I guess, worse condition like that. Some neighborhoods and some parts of the city have just an occasional house that's been abandoned and the overgrown properties around it. And then they're bordered on either side by well-kept properties. So it varies from street to street and from block to block, I know. So it's probably something that the casual visitor or somebody who's never been to the city of Gary would be very alarmed to see. But it is something that certainly you are aware of and the city of Gary administration is aware of. And they're trying to, of course, deal with the problem of dealing with the abandoned houses, the blighted houses themselves. Tell us on what level you've have now gotten things set up to go with the two cleanup days that you have set up in the neighborhoods.
Well, we're going to be leaving from Holy Name here in Cedar Lake on two different days, Thursday the 25th, when we'll go to the cathedral area, and then Saturday the 27th, out to the Emerson neighborhood by Saints Monica and Luke. So we'll be leaving our group here from Holy Name. We'll leave about 8 in the morning each of those days and be back here a little after 3. So our plan is to be from 9 till 2 on site and working. And we'll provide lunch and transportation from Holy Name. If anybody wants to meet us up there, of course, they can meet us there about 9 o'clock or so. Mm-hmm. And help us out. But we're going to be providing lifts and lunch.
That's great. And we'll talk here in just a moment, too, about what anybody that's interested in helping out on the cleanup days, either day, either Thursday the 25th or Saturday the 27th, or be sure to bring so that you're properly prepared to be out there and tackle the mess. But I guess we're mainly concerned, of course, mostly about the neighborhoods around the two churches, and we'll just refer to the cathedral in this case as a church, which of course it is. But the idea is that we're talking about the cathedral, which is a prominent part of the Gary Diocese and has been for decades. And then we've got the Church of the Saints Monica and Luke, which is, I know, it's a sizable church in its own right, but it's considered like a smaller church, I would imagine, in two separate neighborhoods. And we look first here about the neighborhood around the Cathedral of the Holy Angels. What did you notice in particular that you made note of so that when the 25th comes up that you'll be able to take your legion of volunteers to go out and clean up?
Well, what I would encourage the folks going to the cathedral neighborhood to look at is to look at the cathedral itself. Mm-hmm. The cathedral is the parish that belongs to everybody in the diocese. It is everybody's church. Of course, it is the parish church for the people that go to Mass there every week and who sustain the prayer community when we're not having larger diocesan events. And there's a lovely, welcoming, embracing parish community there that gathers for prayer and are deeply committed to the parish and to the neighborhood. But when people come from outside and go to the cathedral area, I'd really like them to look at the cathedral church as just as much their church as their own parish that they come from.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the Saints Monica and Luca neighborhood, they're in the Emerson neighborhood, actually, which is east of downtown in Gary. You've got similar problems, I understand, similar cleanup challenges, I'm sure, that you'll have to face probably, that'll be on the 27th, right?
Right. The cleanup issues, they are what they are. You know, you find an area that just needs some weeds cut or some brush removed or some litter that had blown in from the wind, kind of gathered up just to clean the place up. But when folks go to the Emerson neighborhood, I really would like to say, first of all, this is an historical African-American Catholic community. Some of the first Catholic churches in the area that even welcomed and embraced African Americans into the Catholic Church. And so there's some deep history, not only in the African American community, but also in terms of the civil rights movement and Gary's association with that. And so although it's a smaller congregation, perhaps, than the cathedral, it's a very intentional and very vibrant, very hardworking, committed community. Parish community, mm-hmm. To their church and to their heritage. So when folks come from outside of Gary to the Monica and Luke area, I'd really like them to look at all of the beautifully kept homes that are around the area and say, you know, these folks have been living here and committing here for quite some time, and not to look at the occasional home that needs some repair or maybe even to be torn down. You know, don't look at the overgrowth. Don't look at the abandoned Emerson School. Think of the history of people who had gone to school there and who made that just a wonderful neighborhood in its heyday. And look at those signs of wonderfulness that are still bright, shining spots in that neighborhood.
And we know that the city of Gary proper is the administration is working on dealing with the blight and with the abandoned houses and the like too. It's so they're conscious of that too. But there are the other things the neighborhood that the volunteers should take a look at. As always, when you're dealing with cleanup like this, they're asked to bring work gloves, dress appropriately for some dirty work. Be prepared to get dirty, I think, is what the flyer says. So it's a good way. It's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. Comfy shoes, because you're going to be doing a lot of work outdoors. If you happen to have equipment that you can bring along, trimmers and mowers and blowers and brooms, of course, you're welcome to do that as well, too. The more the merrier when it comes to something like this, to be sure. But we always know that, and I'm sure in this particular case, that very many people who come into the city of Gary are very concerned about safety and their safety and the safety of their friends that will be joining them. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it's a reasonable, rational concern. I mean, even, you know, the people who live there want to be just as safe as anybody does in their own home. And certainly when guests come into a neighborhood to visit and help and work, the residents want to make sure that the guests feel as secure as they do themselves. And so the Gary police are aware of our initiative and will be sort of cruising around, keeping an eye out for us. And also a private security firm will check in and make sure everybody's fine and kind of keep an eye out, and just to make sure that the guests that we bring into the city for the day can feel secure and unworried. And so we've got those kind of things in mind for sure.
And I know, too, that's all really part of the Catholic doctrine and tradition and teachings, too, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. One of the important tenets of Catholic social teaching is the need for experiences of solidarity, that there are more things that we have in common with each other than that divide us. And any opportunity we can find to bridge those obvious divides and find our common sense of humanity, our common baptism, if you want to speak in Christian terms, then those are things we need to do to build up a sense that we really are one human family bound by one another, some of whom struggle in ways that are obvious to others, then maybe others that struggle in ways that are less obvious. But that value, that virtue of solidarity across lines is deep, deep, deep in our Catholic tradition. And it's biblical, of course, too.
Once again, Thursday, July 25th, the group of volunteers going involved for the cleanups that are planned in the Gary neighborhood will be leaving. In fact, they'll be leaving on both days, the 25th as well as on Saturday the 27th, from the Holy Name of Jesus Church in Cedar Lake, and then traveling up to, on Thursday the 25th, the Cathedral of Holy Angels. That's the area west of downtown Gary, there along Tyler Street. And then that's on Thursday. Then on 27th, Saturday, they'll be leaving from Cedar Lake from the church and headed up to the Church of Saints Monica and Luke in the Emerson neighborhood, which also is east of downtown Gary, there at Rhode Island Street. And if anybody has any questions, if they might have missed something that we had talked about in our conversation today, Father Mike, how can people find out more?
Well, you can call Holy Name Church here in Cedar Lake at 219-374-7160. You can call Kevin Driscoll at 219-552-4060, or you can check the website. You go online at bit.ly/cleanupgary.
Well, it's great advice and great information that people should know about, and you'll find out more information, a reminder as to what to wear, what to bring, and things if you can bring. They'll be welcome as well, too, for the two cleanup days that are planned for Thursday, July 25th. And that'll be in the neighborhood to the west of downtown Gary. And then on Saturday, July 27th, in the Emerson neighborhood, which is east of downtown Gary. And it's all because of the efforts of Father Mike and the many volunteers who will be coming in to help do their part to help clean up the city of Gary. And Father Mike, thank you for spending time to tell us about it. And we hope that there's, a legion of people that will be showing up from Cedar Lake headed up into the city of Gary for these two cleanup efforts coming up very soon.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I think it's so critical that we start talking about race. I think we just have to be honest. When I was growing up, it was all white. We had no African Americans in the school. I remember when I was maybe in middle school that there was a whole area of Hispanics, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans that had a little small part of the west side of Lake Station. But I do remember being out on the playground, and then all of a sudden there were these Puerto Rican or Mexican kids, and it was scary. And I think it was because all of my life up till that point, everybody was the same. And I know I must have heard, although I cannot pinpoint, that they were different. We were told as children to stay away from them. I can remember when Martin Luther King was killed. I put a picture on my front door with a black drape over it. I was a young mother, and we lived in the all-white neighborhood, and it was sort of very controversial in the neighborhood. And we lost some friends over it. You know, people came over, and they were very upset that we would feel the loss and could do something so outrageous. But it felt right, because it's like anything. You have to take a stand. You have to be who you are. And I think it's required. My husband and I, when Richard Gordon Hatcher ran for mayor, we worked on his campaign. We worked with what they called the Miller Mafia, which was a group of Jewish people that were lawyers and business people and very liberal. Richard Gordon Hatcher was a brilliant man. We were all happy that he won. I think as the years went on, we all felt disappointment, but I think that we were proud to be one of the cities that elected a black mayor. At that time, it was sort of a badge of honor. When Hatcher won, it was a very, very exciting time because we were breaking new ground. New people were coming in from all over to be part of his administration. I mean, people felt it not just here, but throughout the country. So he was getting very qualified and very well-known people to help him in his administration. And that honeymoon period went on for a while. But there were a lot of issues with the rest of Lake County and Porter County. I mean, people didn't like that there was a black mayor here. And that's how Merrillville and Munster were born. So many people left all parts of Gary to go south. That meant that then there were homes that some were just abandoned or were sold so cheaply that it brought the level of poverty up, because people who couldn't afford it otherwise were moving in. I don't think he did enough to alleviate the fear. Instead of this feeling of that we're a team and we're all working together, it became a very black and white. But like I said, there were also major economic things. I mean, the suburban malls did so much damage. The steel industry collapsing. You know, there were just not the middle class jobs here anymore. I think that the term white flight describes it. You know, unfortunately, that's exactly what it was. It was hysteria, fear, and I understand that people will do anything to protect their families. And we always have to have somebody to hate, it seems. So the more different you are, the easier it is to hate you. The race issue is huge, and I don't think Gary can get anywhere unless we can address the race issue nationally. People don't want black people living next to them. I think we got a long way to go. It feels like the 60s again. You know, it feels like, I don't know, we just haven't made the progress we thought we made.
You can find more stories online at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. Nationwide, e-cigarette use rose at an alarming 78% among high school students last year. The FDA has warned manufacturers to stop marketing to kids by using fruity flavors and colorful packaging. But that hasn't stopped the surge, even in rural areas where the access to stores is limited. Lita Noon has this from a school in Newton County.
North Newton Junior Senior High lies in the northwest corner of Indiana, in a county home to more dairy cows than people. But students have no problem getting e-cigarettes in all shapes and sizes. Some look like pens, others like computer thumb drives.
Probably most people my age, if you're not a smoker or none of that, it could be sitting right in front of you and you wouldn't even know what it was.
That's teacher Bob Gonzi, who took an informal poll of PE students. Junior high kids estimate 65% of their classmates are using vape devices, and high school students think their numbers are even higher. Assistant Principal Jerry Taylor dumps a bag full of confiscated materials onto a desk. There are vape pens, a bottle of marshmallow-flavored e-liquid, an electronic charger, and the highly popular Juul brand devices.
There's been 34 vaping episodes, and we put kids out 3 days.
Taylor explains that without a specific vape policy, they're following the 3-day suspensions of the smoking policy. Because e-cigarettes are so easy to hide, they're very disruptive in classrooms. Health teacher Josh Stringfellow says students blow smoke rings while the teacher is turned away.
They'll film it on Snapchat, send it around the school because, hey, I got away with it in so-and-so's class. I did this trick in this teacher's classroom. And now they're one-upping each other. And that's why they're being caught more easily, is because they're being so blatant about it.
A senior from nearby Lowell High School, Cade Holdeman, says vaping became the hot thing after winter break last year.
It's pretty crazy. It's definitely an epidemic. I mean, for a long time, you like couldn't walk into a restroom without like vapor just being in your face because everybody at some point did it.
Holdeman says he doesn't use e-cigarettes, but his friends do, and his mom, Stacy Stewart, says that's worrisome.
My smart kid over here started hanging out with some not smart kids who did stuff like that, and I mean, it was in his car a lot, and we had a blow up about it. I mean, it's better now, but it's just scary because there's so many health things that kids just don't realize.
And those health consequences are real. Newton County Public Health Nurse Kim Durham says the problem, nicotine.
What we're really still looking at, once again, are people having a nicotine addiction. This is the kind of stuff that leads to heart disease later, that leads to cardiovascular problems, that can lead to pulmonary problems. There's all kinds of different things that can go into play here.
She spoke to 6th and 8th graders at school health fairs.
I was actually mostly surprised because we asked them where they started doing it, and a lot of them said, well, my parents do it. And some of them had, that's kind of how they ended up getting introduced to it, was mom and dad.
Durham says there's a misconception e-cigarettes are safe because some people use them to stop smoking. But she says nicotine levels can be much higher in e-cigarettes. North Newton administrators want to curb the use of e-cigarettes next year. Taylor says they're considering having the local police get involved.
Start ticketing these kids if it's $150 or whatever, and maybe that would curtail them buying these vapes and bringing them into school.
Gonzi agrees that that will make a difference.
You know, we find out here, hold the parents responsible. Hold the parents responsible. You get in their pocketbook a little bit, they'll curb behaviors, especially for their children.
For next fall, Gonzi and Taylor are working toward a school e-cigarette policy. They also want to develop information for the curriculum and for parents. Meanwhile, they'll get some help from the FDA. New ads about the dangers of e-cigarettes are scheduled to hit the airwaves this summer. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee Dinoon.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Congressman Matthias Sklosky's office has put out word that the Environmental Protection Agency has approved a brownfields grant that's coming into Northwest Indiana to deal with some projects in Gary, Hammond, and East Chicago. And the grant for about $600,000 is going to be administered by a coalition that includes the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And we have with us Kathy Luther with NERPC to talk about it and about the other partners in this venture as well, too. Kathy, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit here about the concern. Of course, brownfields seems to never go away here in Northwest Indiana. Tell us what, in this particular case, that the EPA is going to help Northwest Indiana problems with this grant.
This is actually the third brownfield grant we've gotten for regional coalitions over the last 5 years. So actually a number of years ago, NERPC started partnering with the RDA to apply for Brownfields funding, because we recognize, particularly in our urban core, we have a lot of areas that have been industrial, and maybe now they're not to their, used to their best purpose. So we started applying for funds together. We had been advised from the agency that sometimes when our cities apply for grants separately and they're competing against each other, that kind of makes it less likely for EPA to give them funding mm-hmm. because they don't know how to, they don't want to choose or it. So we applied as a coalition with the RDA as the applicant and NERPC as an assistant kind of manager. And then with Gary Hammond and East Chicago in that coalition. And so we've been, that coalition was awarded the same $600,000 grant for assessing brownfields, and then also a revolving loan fund grant, which can be used to clean up brownfields so that they can be redeveloped, and then you get paid back and you can keep on doing that. So then after doing that for quite a few years, it was we have a lot of projects in Gary Hammond and East Chicago kind of queued up. Brownfields have a lot of, I want to say, technical difficulties.
That would be putting it mildly in some
putting
cases,
it mildly.
Too.
And so we used a lot of that funding to conduct a phase one environmental assessment, which is kind of like a cross between if you're buying a home and you do a home get a home inspection done. A phase one environmental assessment is kind of like that home inspection plus like a historical research into the property, what was ever there before, plus what else is in the neighborhood. So you do all that, and you get kind of an idea of whether there's a problem or not.
Do you find that in doing that little history search mm-hmm. on a particular site, and you get to see the bigger picture by you check out what was else in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. we'll say just a light industrial area that may have been mm-hmm. abandoned or something like that over the years, that that you're able to define more problems that maybe you might have to address a little further with more money or with mm-hmm. more remediation work?
That's actually very, very common. What we find is a common thing that happens is folks don't do that phase one before they purchase a property. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that from a federal EPA perspective, if there's contamination there and you didn't do due diligence, you can actually be liable for the problem, especially if you start digging and building. The criteria for a risk are, in many cases, like, are you a half a mile from a problem site? So it could be a residential property. We actually, it could be a residential property, but if it's adjacent to or within a half a mile of a previous gas station, a previous auto shop, a previous manufacturing facility, a previous dry cleaner, any time in the last 100 years, that property will still need to have some advanced sampling done to make sure that none of its neighbors contaminated it.
Are we finding that in particular with these three communities, Gary Hammond and East Chicago, and you found this in other projects too, I'm sure, that these problems crop up primarily because decades, maybe even a century ago, mm-hmm. a particular neighborhood was kind of a combination of places to live and places to do business and mm-hmm. industrial parks and that sort of thing, at least what you could call them back then. There were factories mm-hmm. and the like there too. So we all these brownfields mm-hmm. problems crop up because everybody was clustered together in a particular neighborhood?
I think so too, and because there was not a real understanding of the problems of chemicals. That has even changed in, you know, my professional life. When I was a young environmental lab tech, we used, you know, solvents to dry the dishware.
Oh, yeah.
Sprayed it all around, and now, you know, you would never do that. So that's the case. Even an area that maybe wasn't industrial at all, someone might have had a auto repair shop there just out of their garage. Or maybe it was a someone had a dry cleaner, and then and some areas have turned over, you know, in the last 50 years, and some people remember, oh yeah, there was a fix-it shop there, oh yeah, but you really have to do the research, make sure. That's the called a phase one, where you basically do that research, and then a phase two is where you sample it. Phase one, it ran between $3,000 and $5,000. One of the really important lessons we learned through this first couple of grants we worked on with the RDA in the three cities is that there's a reluctance to spend that $3,000 to $5,000 before acquiring property, and that reluctance to invest that little bit and that due diligence can really cause a lot of heartburn later when you find out there was a problem and you can't get any federal money. One of the reasons we changed up this coalition a little bit, we've changed it. So now it's NERPC and the RDA and the Northwest Indiana Forum. And we're going to work really closely with the forum to do more education and training with our developers in the region and the local governments so that they understand a little better how to put these properties on the market and redevelop them in such a way that we can not get folks in a bind.
Now, they're sort of the experts in this field anyway, aren't they? The forum tends to look into that. They tend to look at properties and then look for the right kind of organizations that can buy them up and turn them back into something.
Another thing, besides most people, when they think of brownfields, they're thinking of underground and soil contamination. But yeah. Another use we can do with the assessment funds is do asbestos assessments. And determine how, and that can be really important prior to any demolition, so that you've remediated the asbestos correctly. And although the assessment funds can't be used to remove the asbestos, just getting a solid measurement of how much is there and having a plan of how to abate it can move that along much faster as well. In fact, one of the things we've used with our cleanup funds is for the Ambassador Apartments in Gary. They had funding to demolish the building from the Office of Community and Rural Affairs, and they had underestimated the asbestos cost there. And because we had the brownfield funds, we were able to make up the difference in the asbestos, get it out of there so they could safely take down the building without endangering the neighborhood.
Well, it's very helpful to have that extra funding available then to work in this case here. When you have this coalition, as you mentioned, it's made up with NERPC, it's made up with the Regional Development Authority, and now with the Northwest Indiana Forum, that this is going to make it certainly make it easier to be able to deal with these brownfields problems. Will you all be able to use the funds that you have available, the $600,000 grant from the EPA, to be able to get more properties together and get them out there and get them reused?
One of the reasons we're focusing on Gary, Hammond, Chicago is because we do have projects queued up there to start right away. But we did make sure with this coalition that we can use these dollars in all the communities in Northwest Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
The best use of these funds, we have found, and in a lot of other parts of the country, is that it clears up the unknown. And so, like, the property may have a economic use and economic value, but the uncertainty of not knowing what's there and what you might have to do to fix it kind of freezes anybody's interest in it. These funds work the best when you already have a developer and you have an end use, and we invest our funds to let them know what's there, plan a cleanup, these assessment grants, figure out what they need to do to get it to the use they want to use it for safely. And then we can use our revolving loan fund to loan them the funds to clean that up. That's the piece that is the most challenging for commercial and private funding to be available for.
Do you know if there are any projects right now in the works, or ones that you're looking at in Gary or Hammond or East Chicago that will be very good candidates to get this initial sections of redevelopment going to in turn attract more developers to look into the opportunities that are out there?
We obviously know that those three cities have an abundance of need, but we can use it for other projects if other communities with older areas needing redevelopment.
So there might be something, for example, in Portage or maybe in Valparaiso or in La Porte for that matter too,
right,
that might be eligible to use this funds, and you want to be sure to take the best advantage of it. Yeah.
Right now, we are working with a project in East Chicago that is a senior housing development, and we are working to get everything queued up with both HUD and with EPA so that we can loan them the funds to do a little bit of soil remediation before they put that housing in. We did a number of phase one assessments in the Miller area, like between 12 and 20 near the Lake Street train station, between there and the county line.
Mm-hmm.
Several of those properties could benefit from further assessment, which will be really important as we move the double track forward for the region, that we have property that's available to be redeveloped. And the city of Gary had targeted that area for both transit-oriented development and light industrial use.
Is this an instance where the folks, for example, at the Northwest Indiana Forum are very excited about getting involved in this because they know that all this work will be done ahead of time and they can make those sites available when they come up to somebody to redevelop and turn to something? And then also to the RDA, too. And like you say, a lot of that, too, I know with the RDA has to deal with the South Shore expansion. Yeah.
I think this we can really leverage this in all of the double track communities. And now, if there's actual contamination or concerns in the NCDD footprint for West Lake Corridor or in the footprint for double track, that will all be fundable through the FTA funds. But, you know, for properties outside of their footprint that may become more valuable or have more potential, we can use some of this funding to help get them ready. And meanwhile, we're going to be kind of teaching more of our development community here how to take advantage of this funding and how to best use these properties without becoming liable for them.
Since everybody is so interested in this what's called transit-oriented development, and they want to be able to push that, in particular, we know that the RDA and for that matter, too, I guess, the Northwest Indiana Forum wants that to happen in more places, especially along the South Shore corridor, that this will help get those projects going in particular.
Yeah.
Kathy, give us an idea if there's anything yet set up here on a timetable now that you have the $600,000 grant to work with.
There's a bunch of paperwork you could imagine that we have to do at the front end. We have to have agreements with the three coalition members. I think that might take a couple months to get all the paperwork through with EPA, and then we will be competitively procuring environmental consultants to actually do the sampling work and the phase one assessments. And then we'll be working with Gary Hamney Chicago Group to get the projects we think we have lined up, make sure we have access to them. That can sometimes slow down the timeline. I'm hoping we can be starting projects maybe by September, October.
Great to hear. Well, a lot of work yet to come now that the EPA has made the Brownfields grant available to Northwest Indiana for these projects in Gary and Hammond and East Chicago and beyond as well to be able to expand outside within the three counties. And Kathy, thank you for spending some time explaining everything and going over the details and all. And it sounds like you're well on your way and we'll have some great projects that will help benefit the communities. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Luther is her title is the chief of staff. She's the point person to help work on some of these projects for the Northwest Indiana Regional Plan Commission. A new statewide campaign to address stigma that's associated with mental illness and substance use disorders that started on Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman tells us that the campaign is designed to help break down the barriers to treatment.
The Indiana Recovery Council developed an awareness campaign to change the way we talk about mental illness and substance use disorders. Chairman David Berman says a language change could be the difference between someone getting treatment and not.
We would never say Jane is cancer. She has cancer. So why would we do the same thing with mental health and substance use disorders?
The Indiana Recovery Council created educational materials for statewide partners. Berman says it will also promote the campaign at conferences across the state this summer. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
Coming up on July 13th, to be held in the town of Highland, is going to be the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event. It's being billed as a one-day, family-friendly, LGBTQ+ supportive festival. And the organizations that are putting all this together include the LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and PFLAG Crown Point and Pride Events Incorporated organizations. And we have with us the two people that are organizing and running both of these organizations as well as the big event coming up this summer. Amari Victoria is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and Elizabeth Manning is the president of PFLAG Crown Point, which is a support group organization. We'll find out more about that shortly. And also with the Pride Events Incorporated, which is an organization you all set up to help get the Pride event underway. Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay. Well, first, Amari, if you will, tell us the involvement that you have, a personal as well as, I guess, in a way, a support group and professional feeling that you have about helping organize not only what you've done for the group that you help support, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, but also the idea of having the very first Northwest Indiana Pride.
Thank you, Chris. My organization, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, was formed after I discovered that there was really no support in Northwest Indiana for transgender folks like myself. And I decided that I needed to have support that was local, more local than a two-hour car ride away from our hometown of Crown Point. So I formed LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and started a transgender support group, as well as a discussion group for parents and guardians of transgender children. Those have been going on for almost a year now on a monthly basis. And that the fact that there was no support here also meant that there were no services that I could find.
Elizabeth, how do you fit into the picture now?
So I'm Amari's spouse, and we got married before she discovered she was transgender. When she discovered that, of course, I was going to stick by her side and go through the journey with her. As we were looking for support, as she mentioned, there were no places in Northwest Indiana. We were traveling to Goshen or to Michigan City. They have a great PFLAG chapter there, and found them very inspirational as well as helpful. So I turned to her one day and said, you know, I want to start a transgender support group in our area. And she said, no, you can't. I said, why? She said, because I'm going to. So she did. And then I started a PFLAG chapter, which is designed to support the families, friends, allies, and members of the LGBTQ community.
I guess, and PFLAG has been around, it's national, of course, and it's been around here in the region for some time, at least in other states. Besides the fact that there was no local chapter, what prompted you to decide to get PFLAG going here in the region?
Well, there are not many spouses that stay with people once those people come out as transgender, and there's a lot of confusion about, especially among parents who have children, and it is crucial to be accepted by family and friends and schoolmates and teachers, because if kids aren't supported, there is just such a terrible suicide rate. And just to be able to help people understand what the LGBTQ world is and be able to accept everybody as equal individuals, I think it was just, it's become a burning passion of mine, as it is Amari's.
Let's talk about LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and getting that organization started. What does it offer to residents here in the area that are interested, are inquisitive, but want to get involved?
Well, besides the support groups, which are already established, I feel that education is extremely important, not only for people within the LGBTQ community, but the community at large. So I have been co-hosts or presented various educational topics. A couple of suicide prevention workshops were performed with in conjunction with Geminis Regional Health Systems. And my doctor, who is located in Goshen, Indiana, has been out here in Northwest Indiana to present two different health-related topics, one about hormone replacement therapy for transgender people and another about sensitivity and awareness for the medical profession and healing arts professions.
I know that your intent is to be able to bring to the general public a view of what the LGBTQ community is here in Northwest Indiana. It's education as well as entertainment, I guess you could say. Let's talk a little bit first of what's going to be planned here for the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event in Highland this summer. And where does first the educational aspect come in?
Well, the educational aspect would come in that we have a variety of vendors who will be at the event that will be promoting their services in Northwest Indiana, some of them general for the general public, but most of them also focusing on the LGBTQ community. Health services and mental health services are very important in the area for our community.
We're going to be offering free health screenings for people. As people come in, we're going to have some information about the gender spectrum, the gender identity, sexual orientation, and gender expression, the differences between that. So there'll be posters around and some displays and different booths handing out information so they can stop by and see all that.
Now, we talked about education, and then, of course, then we mentioned entertainment. That probably comes in many facets. Tell us at least what's planned now for happening during the very first Northwest Indiana Pride when it comes to entertainment.
Okay, I'm going to tell you about our headliner musical act. That is the Brian Carmona Band. And he's just wonderful blues and rock, modern rock, classic rock, with a twist. He blends in a lot of R&B and soul with his music, and we're very happy to have him as our headlining musical act.
Yeah, we have some drag shows lined up, both family-friendly during the day and then an adult drag show during the after party. Drag Kings are also going to be there. We've got another band. We'll have a Zumba class. We have a poetry reading or story reading, basically spoken word session. And we actually do have some weddings and vow renewals that will be taking place,
oh, really?
As well as kids' entertainment.
Well, that's great. Now, when you mentioned it, the point I'm sure is going to bring people's attention right to what you mentioned about drag shows, and you talk like a family-friendly drag show. That's interesting. How would you define that for somebody that is not aware of what that would be?
So a family-friendly drag show means that the language is proper and the displays are not risque and the clothing is not risque. It'll be entertaining, you know, for the children. It'll be at a level where they can enjoy it. More of the kind of glam style or Vegas style type of drag show during the day.
Have you found in talking with people and as you're getting the event organized for this summer that maybe when you mentioned, well, this is what we have lined up, what we'd like to do, some of the events and the activities, you have music and you have the poetry readings, and now you mentioned that when you get to the other entertainment events too, people kind of give you a strange look as to what's this all about? Or do you think that maybe people in Northwest Indiana are becoming a bit more familiar of this?
Well, as far as drag shows are concerned, I believe that most people probably know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
RuPaul's Drag Race on TV probably helps that out a bit. I think the opinions of drag performers is mixed. But we hope to at least get across to the general public that drag shows are meant to be entertaining.
When you talk about some of the other things, you talk about a wide variety of genres of music and the like, and you talk about the poetry readings and all too. Do you think that this is going to be a surprise to anybody that happens to attend the event in July?
I think some of it will be a surprise. The reactions we've been getting when talking to local businesses and individuals has been surprisingly and pleasingly positive. Mm-hmm. They're excited that this is coming to Northwest Indiana. We've got a great DJ lined up, too, who's going to help us coordinate all these performers and the music. Colorblind celebrations. And I think that it's just going to be a lot of fun for people.
You have mentioned about the fact that you do have a lot of support from organizations and from businesses and the like here in the region as you get things organized here. And you mentioned that you've gotten a lot of support, at least mentioned so far, in doing so. How much work would you say it has become since this is your very first event, although you've done other, I'm sure, fundraisers and the like. In fact, you had a fundraiser just not long ago, and you have more planned in advance of the Pride event coming up in July. But on a scale, we'll say, that ranges from putting on a bake sale to doing the Gary Ayer show, where do you think that, at least right now, what the NWI Pride seems to range on that scale?
I believe our estimate right now would hang a lot closer to the air show.
Especially personally.
It is unbelievable how many facets there are involved in putting together a show of this size, an event of this size.
Do you think that since you're doing a lot of this work yourself and doing a lot of the organizing yourself, is it helping to have such good support out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do have a good planning team to help us through these ventures. We wish we had a bigger planning team at this point.
Well, do you think that might change maybe with future events, that the more people here attend in July, see what it's all about, and when it's time to look for planning future Northwest Indiana Pride events, that it's gonna pick up with the support as well as the helpers that will help make it possible?
We believe so. This is meant to be a community event, and we hope to bring together both members of the LGBTQ+ community as well as the community at large to see that we are no different from each other. We are all people who work and play in this area, Northwest Indiana, and that what we're doing is good for the community. We hope that we will have people coming to us and saying we'd like to help.
All our organizations build a thriving and robust LGBTQ and ally community in this area. And this area, I mean the five-county region that Wikipedia defines Northwest Indiana to be, Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper counties. And there will be many, many opportunities for volunteer work during the event. And we're hoping to build a good volunteer base as well that can help us throughout the year as we do other events.
Now, if anybody is interested in finding out more about this very first, what hopes to be a series of annual Northwest Indiana Pride events happening this year, happening at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland, where can people find out more? And if they'd like to get involved, even though you're through the into the planning process already, where they can get a hold of you to show you their support?
I think the best way for people to see what's going on and contact us would be to go to our website, www.nwi-pride.org.
We're talking with Amari Victoria, who is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and with Elizabeth Menning, who is the president of PFLAG Crown Point and also the CEO of Pride Events Incorporated. And they together and others in their team are helping put together the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event, which is going to be happening in July, on July 13th. And it's a one-day event that's going to be held at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland. And ladies, thank you for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, since our conversation, Amari and Elizabeth tell us that there is one change of note, and that is when the evening's programs on Saturday will end. They will end at 11:30 p.m. instead of midnight to accommodate the Lincoln Community Center staff. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we will have, including our conversations, revisiting the one we had with Scott Pelath, who is the executive director of the Kankakee and Yellow River Basin Development Commission. We hope you can join us.